ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. The new Katherine Water Allocation Plan has been released today by the NT Government. I'll be speaking to the Water Minister, Joshua Burgoyne, in just a moment to learn all about this new plan. Also this afternoon, you'll hear from a farmer in Darwin's rural area who has increased his plantings of tomatoes because demand is strong and they taste great.
Our tomato, if you bite into it, it makes you smile. It's such an amazing product to eat. It's quite firm, but very juicy and very lots of flavours in it.
Yep, he's upped his plantings and is now probably the biggest tomato crop in the Northern Territory. I'll be taking you there before 1:30. And I've also got some new music from the Sunny Cowgirls to share with you this afternoon. It's an absolute ripper of a tune. I hope you'll enjoy it. We are broadcasting right across the territory this afternoon on the ABC. G'day there if you've tuned in via the podcast. As we go to air this afternoon, the Stuart Highway, 20 kilometres south of Daly Waters, it is open to traffic, but it's down to one lane only, and this is because of an accident that happened earlier today. The cleanup is ongoing, and if you are driving along this stretch of the Stuart Highway this afternoon, you might notice a lot of rock melons. Sam Parry joins us this afternoon from the nearby Highway Inn. Sam, tell us what's happened there on the Stuart Highway.
Yeah, that's right, Matt. Well, in the early hours of this morning, a road train, the third trailer actually on a triple road train, has flipped over and dropped all of its cargo. Well, not all of it, a fair whack of its cargo of rock melons across the road. They've strewn everywhere into the culvert, and this trailer's left, you know, a pretty big mess as it's become detached and flipped over. So, yeah, bit of a mess there. But the southbound lane has been closed this morning. It's all blocked off just in the south direction. The traffic's been able to pass very slowly just by going around with the help of some traffic controllers who have arrived this morning. The word has spread pretty quickly here at the Highway Inn. There were some tourists a bit concerned they might not be able to get through once the authorities have to close the road and maybe start putting the trailer upright. But that's yet to happen, so just waiting to see how they'll deal with it.
Is the truckie okay?
Yes, the truckie is unharmed. The driver is all in good health. However, a female passenger did sustain minor injuries.
Okay, now you've been at the site. Rock melons strewn absolutely everywhere. Are there a few people making the most of a fresh, slightly bruised rock melon?
There were, actually. There was someone, one motorist pulled over in his ute and just went into the culvert and grabbed a few, looked very happy with his haul, put them in the back of his tray and put the tonneau cover over the top. So, yeah, there'll be a few happy people travelling south on the Stuart and getting an unexpected feed of rock melons.
Of rock melon. Oh, dear, oh, dear. All right, well, thank you for keeping us up to date. Just before you go, though, how was Newcastle Water Station late yesterday and the mates of the Murrinjoy?
Yeah, that was a fantastic celebration. It was great to see so many people coming from all over Australia and celebrating something that, you know, clearly they're very passionate about, preserving this part of Australia's pastoral history. Of course, the Murrinjoy Track has this reputation, a legendary reputation of being one of the most formidable and challenging stock routes in Australia. And, you know, just so many stories and anecdotes. You know, I don't know how many of them were embellished, but some very interesting yarns being spun from some very passionate history buffs who are keen to see that track and also Newcastle Waters as a historic township preserved.
Newcastle Waters, that could have been the capital if the North Australian Act had stayed in place.
That's right.
I'm still trying to picture Parliament House in Darwin, but plonked, you know, close to Lake Woods. What a sight that would be.
It would have been majestic, the wedding cake overlooking the wetlands.
Yeah, oh, special, absolutely special. All right, well, we look forward to hearing more from Newcastle Waters in the coming days. Thanks for your time this afternoon. Appreciate it.
Great. Thanks so much, Matt.
That's Sam Parry. He's at the Highway Inn this afternoon near Daly Waters there. And just repeating, the Stuart Highway, it is open, but one lane only at the moment because of this accident that happened in the wee hours of this morning. So if you're along that part of the Stuart Highway, just be aware and maybe expect the odd delay. And I guess keep an eye out for those rock melons.
Yeah, my name's Spud Smith. I'm originally from Mungindoi, but I live in Umpty-Doo and I love the country here and keep it up. Love it.
It's 25-1. An organic farmer in the Top End has ramped up his production of tomatoes this year. Bluey Stolt has just started harvesting his tomato crop out near Middle Point. The crop covers about half a hectare, and that probably makes it the biggest commercial tomato patch in the Northern Territory. Bluey says it is a challenging crop to grow, but demand is strong.
We are a farm who really want to be a local producer, and it seems that we have to learn to grow these products, which everybody wants, and through good marketing. And if we can grow them, we can maybe have a bigger share in the local market. And we realized we couldn't sell pumpkins in Darwin in tons, or we couldn't sell watermelon in tons that much. But cucumbers, zucchinis, eggplants, we can sell quite a bit local, and that's why we could choose in tomatoes. But tomatoes is a very hard crop to grow and a bit unpredictable. That's why we'll see how we go this year.
Are you getting lots of interest from local suppliers?
We only start harvesting 5 days ago. And we just start telling people that we've got tomatoes because we weren't sure what we're going to harvest. But the quality seems amazing. Like when you eat them, they are, you know, I haven't eaten a tomato like that for a long time. That's why it's definitely, there's some of the AGA stores in town who are quite keen. And there's, if we just only put the word out in the last week and see what we can sell, what we produce, what our quality is going to be in the next few weeks, and how the crop is going to perform.
What's the Top End tomato industry like? Are there any other tomato growers?
It seems in the 70s and 80s, there were a lot of tomato growers and backyard people who the community could go to and pick themselves. Or there were growers in, I think, near Coolalinga who grow for years on the same patch growing tomatoes, but right now there's nobody else growing tomatoes because it's so challenging. We tried, at the first 2 years, we tried to grow tomatoes, but sometimes you get them up to just harvest and then they all got wilt disease and they all get wiped out. And the diseases you get, it's mainly soil-borne, and if you get any problems, it stays on your farm for years. That's why we have to be, we have to find varieties to work, and now we have built our soil to something really great, and I just feel we maybe now can grow tomatoes.
What varieties are you growing?
There's only one there, which, because I'm not going to do the labor work, like I'm not going to put trellising up or shade houses and all this. We just grow a bush tomato, which somebody recommended to us, and you just plant it, like a zucchini or anything, and then you go and harvest after maybe, I don't know, 7 weeks or something. And it's called a bush tomato, which is a really old variety, and it grows, looks in the moment, it grows, looks amazing. See what's going to happen.
Can you describe what it looks and tastes like?
Oh, that's an interesting one. It's like when you grab a tomato, like in the shops, it seems it's always watery. The color's perfect, everywhere perfect color and perfect shape. But you bite into it and you think it's quite hard and a bit watery. I sometimes think it's a bit like a hard lump of water. It's not much flavor, not much taste. That's why everybody buys sherry tomatoes. But our tomato, if you bite into it, it feels like a bit of, it's a consistency like you would imagine a tomato should taste like as the juice runs down your cheeks, and you really like, it makes you, yes, smile. It's such an amazing product to eat. It's quite firm, but very juicy and very lots of flavors in it. It's just an old tomato. What do you imagine tomato should taste like?
What sort of volume are you growing?
Oh, we only planted maybe half a hectare all up. Like we only planted a few thousand plants, and we had a challenge in the nursery because it seems like they don't like the high humidity. Like when we try to plant the seedling, because it takes nearly a month from seeding until you plant it out, but when we planted it after a month, there were still only a centimeter high and tiny, crumbly little plants. And then we tried to repot them, and we did a lot of work until We kind of learned we have to put them in 1 litre pots and then grow them out to like a foot high and then plant them in the field. And then, yes, grow them. They're like a bush. You don't stake them or put no... You do nothing beside planting them. But it was a huge learning curve to get them established at the very start, you know.
And will they just be for sale locally?
Nah, we sell them to market. But at the moment, there's a glut of organic tomatoes from Queensland. And tomatoes, when you think about it, cucumbers are maybe $5 a kilo. And tomatoes at the moment is like $2. Like, we can't send them to Perth, really. I had to send them to Sydney or Melbourne. It's just for us. It's a freight. It's just, you're not going to make a cent out of it. That's why we try to sell them local. But the plan was, I would love to grow 5 hectares of tomatoes and send them to the markets, you know. But it seems that everybody's doing that now. That's why there's a total oversupply of tomatoes.
Obviously, only early days. But are you thinking you'll do it again next year?
Oh, in this stage, yeah. I'm very excited about that. I think, like, stuff like pumpkins and watermelons, for us growing 1 or 2 hectares, it's just not really worth doing. You know, the production costs $1.60 and you get $2. You make $200 a ton and you only do 20 ton. It's just not worth doing for us. But it feels in the book and we sell some local and it feels good growing a crop.
That is organic tomato grower Bluey Stolt speaking there to George Nicol. It's 19 to 1 and you are tuned into the Country Hour. The new Katherine Water Allocation Plan, it has been released today. What's in it? What do farmers need to know? Up next, you will hear from the NT's Water Minister, Joshua Burgoyne. But first, I've got some new music to share with you this afternoon. It's new music from the Sunny Cowgirls, and the song is called Weather Dad. And I'm tipping that we've got a few Weather Dads listening to the Country Hour this afternoon. We'll definitely have some daughters and sons of Weather Dads. So I hope you enjoy this new music by the Sunny Cowgirls. I hope it puts a smile on your face this Tuesday lunchtime.
Have you got a weather dad who checks the forecast every hour or so? Weather dad.
New music from the Sunny Cowgirls and a shout out to all of the weather dads who are listening to the Country Hour this afternoon. Our text number is 0487 99 1057. I've got a message and a beautiful picture here from Paul in Malak, who says he's growing some pretty good tomatoes at the moment in his Malak garden. I've got lots of them, he says, but they're not quite ready to eat just yet. But judging from the picture, Paul, you're on to a winner there. You've cracked the secret of growing a good tomato by the looks of things. Another message here from Big Pete, who says, Matt, I received a copy of the Sunny Cowgirls and their new song, Weather Dad. It's a cracker of a song, says Big Pete this afternoon. I've also got a note here to pass on to you that if you'd like to see some pictures of the rock melon carnage strewn along the Stuart Highway this afternoon after that accident earlier today involving a road train, there's some pictures up on the ABC Darwin Facebook and Instagram pages right now.
This August, Science Week is blooming around the ABC.
We're celebrating Australia's wildflowers.
Vote now. Get involved at abc.net.au/science.
The Northern Territory Government has today released the new Katherine Water Allocation Plan. The estimated sustainable yield is 39,000 megalitres a year, and compared to the previous plan, no extra water has been made available for extraction. I had a chat to the Water Resources Minister, Joshua Burgoyne, earlier today and asked what farmers need to know about this new 10-year plan.
What we've seen, I guess, in regards to this plan is not huge changes on a wholesale level. It really is about ensuring that we're protecting the water that's currently there now and into the future and giving people certainty. I think some of the things that obviously has been spoken about in the past is about when we have actually been able to get back some of that water allocation. And I think what's really important to understand is, although there is 32,000 megalitres of the 39,000 megalitres licensed, the actual usage of that licensed water is still very low. So that means a lot of that water is still there for the environment, and obviously it's able to be utilised sustainably. but the level of utilisation is still well under the estimated sustainable yield.
Still, does your government and the department want to claw a bit more water back from the ag sector?
It's a really interesting discussion, Matt, and I actually spoke with a grower over the weekend about this. I think what we need to be doing now as a government is giving growers certainty. So whilst there's been, over a long period of time, that need to claw some water back in certain areas, I think what this plan shows is that we believe we've got the levels about right, because there's not been a huge amount of change. What we want to see is obviously growers continue to use that water allocation. That's what it's there for. It's there to be utilised, and they've got that licensed water because they believe they're going to use it, whether it be for agriculture or other means. And we then want to get the economic benefit. And that, when we talk about the estimated sustainable yield, it's what can be taken sustainably whilst protecting the environment and all the other things that we hold so dear here in the Northern Territory, because water is life.
Every year, irrigators around Katherine have to wait for the department to do an assessment and then provide a number on how much of their allocation they'll get for the calendar year. That's been tinkered with a little bit. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, so for those that I guess know how this works, you're absolutely right. In the past, there's obviously, depending on whether it's a dry year or a wet year, those allocations are played with. I think the improved announced allocation method now, which will mean there's one trigger, there's reduction. So any reduction to any license is now capped at that 30%. And it really does aim to give growers more certainty about their water sustainability now and into the future. But what I will say on that is that when you have the estimated sustainable yield, when you have only 30% of licensed water actually being used in the Katherine area, and obviously we've had some very successful wet seasons up in the Katherine area, what this shows is that we are managing that groundwater very effectively. And I just had some figures provided to me that the actual groundwater levels in the Katherine area are as healthy now as they were back in the 1970s, before a lot of that development took place in Katherine. So the fact that we've been monitoring the
is
water
is that because
levels
we just
Katherine
had the second
area.
Biggest flood in Katherine on record, though?
It's when we measure that, it's over a long period of time. Okay. So it's not just due to this last wet season, but it shows that over a long period of time, we've been managing that water sustainably. And I think that's a really important part of why these plans are important for the areas. We get a lot of people coming out, obviously contesting the science and all the rest of it. But when we actually look over a long period of time at the water levels, at the water that's there for agriculture and the water that's there for community, what we are seeing is a sustainable usage of the water resource that's available.
On contesting the science, I see in the beneficial users column there's 100 megalitres a year for the environment. There is, of course, the big dot point next to it that explains that amount's allocated to the environment to meet a requirement in the Water Act, and that volume's then added to all of the water that's outside of the estimated sustainable yield. But it's this quirk of the Water Act that's currently being challenged in court right now with the Matarenka water allocation plan. You must be confident of winning that case, yes? Otherwise, why would you keep doing this?
Yeah, look, in regards to the legislation, absolutely. And as a minister, I won't speak directly to the court action that's underway, because that wouldn't be proper. But what I will say is that it's really important that the water legislation is constant and that it meets the ever-changing needs. And I think what we're doing now with our water allocation plans is we're clearly articulating exactly how much water we are reserving for the environment. Obviously, everything outside of the estimated sustainable yield is that water for the environment, and we often talk about very large aquifers. So I think it'll be something that I look at as minister into the future about whether that legislated water for the environment as part of the water allocation plans is still necessary into the future, because it does confuse people and it does give if I could speak quite frankly, a misrepresentation of exactly how much water is there for the environment.
In this plan, there's water for Aboriginal economic development. So Katherine now has this Aboriginal water reserve to the tune of 3,220 megalitres a year. Just want to ask you, what do you think success looks like in 5 years' time with that allocation?
Success, in my mind, is that either the Aboriginal people that own the land that are able to have that water allocated to them are utilising it themselves, or are trading it to someone else that wishes to utilise that water. It's there for economic development. It's there for economic gain for those Aboriginal people. And this is something that's often spoken about at a federal level. And I think the Northern Territory is a real leader in this space. We're ensuring that there's water there for Aboriginal economic development. Obviously, one of my biggest frustrations is that we haven't seen any of that water utilised right across the territory. And certainly my goal is to actually see Aboriginal people coming together, whether that be with growers and agricultural people, and actually utilising that water that's been set aside for them.
And this plan, it doesn't include taking wet season flows from the Katherine River. Are you seeing any interest from companies looking to do this?
No, look, I think when we look at sort of the wet season flows, and it's going to be something that's obviously spoken about a lot when we look at the Adelaide River allocation and arrows into the future. I think it's something that at the moment isn't necessarily being spoken about at a huge, huge level. There's plenty of water available through the current allocation plan, obviously, for those that wish to use it for irrigation, agricultural purposes. And it's really, again, it's something that will form part of probably future plans. But right now, as we look towards the one that's in front of us, there's plenty of water under the current estimated sustainable yield to be utilised, whether it be for public water supply, economic development, or any other user. So it really does strike the right balance. And I think something that when we talk about those wet season flows will be something that we'll look at into the future.
And finally, Minister, this plan is meant to flow, good pun, Matthew, meant to flow into the Daly River Water Allocation Plan. What is the latest on that plan? I haven't heard much on it for a while.
Yeah, I don't have an exact update today, but I can absolutely get onto the department and find out exactly where it's up to. My focus has been on ensuring that the Alice Springs and Katherine plans can be declared and then move on to the next one. So that's probably where my attention will be next.
Thank you for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Matt.
That's the NT's Water Resources Minister, Joshua Burgoyne. So the new Katherine Water Allocation Plan, it's out today. You can read it for yourself via the department's website.
These are the Muster Dogs, asking you to vote for Lisa Miller for the 2026 Gold Logie Award, because she's perfect.
Aw, thanks, guys.
Vote now at tvweeklogies.com.au.
Big news today is that the federal government has announced it will start rolling out a vaccination program to protect vulnerable native species from the deadly H5 strain of bird flu. So as explained on the Country Hour yesterday, the vaccine is not available yet to commercial poultry operations, but it is now available to protect threatened species, with zoos likely to be the first in line for this vaccination program. The Federal Ag Minister Julie Collins, the Chief Vet Dr. Beth Cookson, and the Federal Environment Minister Murray Watt spoke to media a short time ago. Let's have a listen.
Today's announcement is another step in supporting our bird population to face up to the massive challenge of bird flu. As the Environment Minister, I very much welcome this development and this announcement by Minister Collins to roll out targeted vaccinations of priority native species. As we've heard, Australia has been doing vaccination trials for some period of time, and now we're making a commitment to roll out those vaccinations more broadly, with the federal government supporting states and territories to vaccinate priority species that they identify based on expert advice. It is difficult to vaccinate birds in the wild. It does take two vaccination doses to vaccinate birds, and it is difficult enough to catch wild birds once, let alone twice. Where it's possible to vaccinate wild birds, we will do so, but the priority here is to vaccinate birds that are in captivity. And of course, in our zoos and various other institutions, we've been taking steps to ensure that we do have populations of our most vulnerable bird species, and they're going to be the priority when it comes to vaccinations. We're taking this step now because, of course, the situation regarding bird flu in Australia is escalating. We're taking a graduated response to step up that response as developments unfold based on expert advice.
What are some of the species that we can expect to see vaccinated, and how many species will you be targeting straight up?
So that obviously depends on the work that the states and territories are doing in relation, as I said, to captive native species, but also whether or not the vaccines are effective in that species. But also it's obviously part of the response. For some threatened species, the response might not include vaccines. It might be much more about biosecurity. It might be much more about resilience of that species. But I'll hand to Dr. Cookson to answer the details of that question.
The trials and pilots that we've undertaken so far has provided us some safety data across a range of different species, and there's now active consideration being taken with our state and territory colleagues who are guiding the prioritisation of those species and the identification of the populations that can appropriately be vaccinated.
So you can't say where you would start or which species or which geographic locations or facilities?
So the states and territories will be making their own announcements in coming days in relation to starting the vaccinations and what they've identified as their priority species. So we've been working very closely with them. I'm not going to make that announcement on their behalf.
So there you go. The federal government announcing today that it's going to roll out this vaccination program to protect vulnerable native species. But it'll be up to the states and territories to determine what those priority species are. I wonder what the Northern Territory government's going to do in this space. What birds in the Northern Territory should be vaccinated? You might have your own thoughts this afternoon. 0487 99 1057. What should be vaccinated in the Northern Territory? I wouldn't think it would get too many vials, to be honest. But what should we be vaccinating? Have a think of that. I'll see you back here in 5 minutes' time.
My name is Tu from Tu's Garden. My farm is in Acacia Hills, and we are gearing up for the fabulous mango seasons, and you listen to Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. In a moment, you'll hear from truckie Kylie Staines, who says it's not just the Sandover Highway that needs urgent repairs. The list of roads that are battered and bruised in the Northern Territory is a long list.
Some of these roads, there's no even pavement left. You know, huge potholes, washouts, and it's not just from the recent rain event.
You'll hear more from Kylie Staines in just a moment on the topic of roads. Just repeating our top story today, the Stuart Highway, 20 kilometres south of Daly Waters. It is open to traffic this afternoon, but one lane only, as authorities clean up after an accident there earlier today. One passenger suffered minor injuries, is what we've been told. And if you are driving along that stretch of the Stuart Highway this afternoon, you may see a lot of rock melon on the side of the road. Just before the 1 o'clock news, I shared with you this story about the federal government rolling out a vaccination program to protect vulnerable native species. I've got a few questions on the text line here, so I'll try and share a few more details with you. I've got here that birds in captivity are likely to be the priority with this vaccination program, so they're expecting probably zoos to be first in line. The Federal Ag Minister says the federal government has secured $2 million worth of vaccines, amounting to roughly 1,500 vials of vaccine. So this is to protect birds from the deadly H5 strain of bird flu. But it will be up to the states and territories to determine what the priority species are. So my question to you this afternoon is, if you're the Northern Territory government and the feds have rung you up this afternoon and said, righto, Territory, we're going to give you, what, a few hundred vials so that you can protect whatever birds you want to protect, what should we vaccinate in the Northern Territory? Do we call up some of our wildlife parks and pick their brains? I don't know. You might know. 0487 99 1057. If the Territory is going to be given a few vaccinations to protect vulnerable native species, what should we give the jab to? 0487 99 1057 is the text number here at the Country Hour. Let's go to the Weather Bureau now. Sally Cutter's there this afternoon. How are you, Sally?
Oh, not too bad, thanks.
Is there much going on weather-wise today?
Oh, yes and no.
We've had some good fogs around the top end and into the Carpentaria district this morning, but generally it's relatively quiet at the moment. But we do have a trough that's approaching the southwest, and that will go through tonight. So we do have a bit of cloud. We might see the odd shower around out of it, particularly in the eastern parts of the territory tomorrow, and maybe around the northeast coast. Just a sign of how much moisture there is in the atmosphere. But when that change comes through, we're going to see temperatures drop of maybe up to 8 degrees in the south, and then they turn southeasterly, so quite windy, and that's also going to bring those fire dangers up, particularly in the grasslands or in the Barkly.
Okay, how blustery could things get in the Barkly later on?
It's going to be sort of pretty close to your standard Barkly breeze, but it's also going to be fairly widespread. So we're probably looking to your standard wind gusts up to about that sort of 30 knots, 60 kilometres an hour. So it's pretty standard for sort of these surges coming through. But it, of course, with the wind and the dryness in the air, that's going to really kick those fire dangers up.
In the top end, what do people need to be aware of over the next few days?
Probably initially the fogs. If you're out and about, they might be a little bit foggy. So just in the early morning, so just take care on the roads. We are going to see that dry air get into the top end sort of late in the week, probably more Friday. And then see those winds picking, those southeasterly winds picking up a little bit. So that's probably the main thing. If you're heading out on the waters, just make sure that you're aware that we sort of towards the end of the week, those light winds on the west coast westerlies will turn around to be southeasterlies, and they'll be picking up on the east coast and in the north.
Beauty. There's no warnings out today. It's all pretty nice. We played a song earlier on, Sally Cutter, new music from the Sunny Cowgirls. It's called Weather Dad. Have a quick listen.
Have you got a weather dad who checks the forecast every hour or so? If there's a drop of rain coming, he needs to know.
Did you have a weather dad, Sally Cutter? Is that how you got into all things weather?
No, it was actually a geography teacher. That there's a unit in teaching, so when I did Year 8 geography, and Mum worked as a secretary with the Department of Meteorology at Melbourne Uni, and somebody she worked with, her son-in-law, was a forecaster.
Rightio. So mostly yeah, thanks to your mum then.
Yeah.
On the text line, I swear this, Sally Cutter, on the text line someone has messaged in, Sally Cutter is our weather mum. If the team there at the Bureau haven't heard this new song by the Sunny Cowgirls, make sure you crank it up later today. I think they'll enjoy it. Yeah.
Good day.
Have a lovely afternoon, Weather Mum.
Thanks very much.
You've got a weather dad. Have you got a weather dad? Who knows the season's going to be wet or going to be dry? Or if that wind is going to cause a night?
It is 11 past one and you are tuned into the Country Hour. We're getting towards the middle of August and the Sandover Highway is still closed due to flooding that happened earlier this year. A 350-kilometre stretch of that highway between Emeroo and the Queensland border has been closed now for months and months. And according to Stuart Weir from Emeroo Station, the government has not sent a single grader out yet to try and patch it up.
The Sandover from Emeroo turnoff through to the border via Lake Nash hasn't been touched at all this year, and it's basically impassable. There's been no machines whatsoever on it, not at all. One of the local civil contractors from Tennant has been along there, and they've earmarked what needs to be done, but they certainly haven't been given the green light to even make a start yet that I'm aware of.
Stuart Weir from Emeroo Station speaking to us a few days ago. The Country Hour has since been told that a $12 million contract has been awarded to repair the Sandover Highway, but it seems a lot of that repair work is set to take place over the next wet season, which has got a few people scratching their heads. Kylie Staines from Staines Transport says the Sandover is one of many roads in Central Australia that need urgent repairs.
The road network across Central Australia sadly hasn't had the work done to it that it should have had done to it. And it's not just this one rain event that's caused this damage. We've had rain event after rain event after rain event. So you've got compounded issues with the road network because repairs and maintenance haven't been happening. So yes, a funding package is great, but you know, $13 million, I don't really know what that's actually going to get done to prevent that road from closing again, because we're already in August and before you know, the rain's going to be happening again towards the end of the year.
The repairs are expected to sort of take place over the wet part of the year. Is that normal? And what's the risk of more flooding happening while the repairs are taking place?
Well, I mean, the repairs should be ongoing all the time. There's much more substantial, continual works that need to happen on a consistent basis throughout the year, and repairs throughout the year to get on top of this road network that's literally just eroding. Like, there are some of these roads where there's no even pavement left. Like, there's a, you know, huge potholes, washouts, and it's not just from the recent rain event. This has been a discussion that we've been having with the government for years. I've jumped up and down, George. I've nearly done cartwheels and spun on my head. But I'm not seeing the consistency around addressing the repairs that need to happen on these roads throughout the year. It's kind of like, oh, suddenly it rains and then suddenly everything becomes urgent. And then, oh my gosh, we've got to get out there and we've got to get on top of these roads.
The government has announced a $30.5 million road repair package, which it says has been spent. Are you seeing the results of that, do you think?
I'd like to know specifically where that's gone. So as a prolific road user across Central Australia, I would like to know specifically what roads in Central Australia and the Barkly that money has gone towards. So if the $30 million, that's wonderful, that would have got us out of trouble, I would hope. But now what's the plan moving forward in allocating money so that we can have the road inspectors on the ground doing their job? We've got the grader crews out there doing their job in rebuilding and repairing these roads and continually grading so that when my trucks go out there, that the freight can actually travel over a road that is not literally going to just continue to bounce them all over the place.
Other than the Sandover Highway, which roads in Central Australia need urgent attention, would you say?
I mean, I'm pretty sure Minister Yan's office has probably had enough of me jumping up and down about it, but I'm going to continue. The Kintore Road, they've done some works on that, correct, but there's still issues. Then you've got the Tanami Road, which, yes, like sealing it, that's fantastic, but there's still dirt there that needs to be looked after. And then you've got the road network past Newmont Tanami. So there's more and more happening on that dirt road network past Newmont. So we're doing a lot of work up that way.
A lot of people probably think that these roads are pretty remote, which they are, but how many people are impacted by the closures of roads and roads being in bad condition in Central Australia?
Thousands, you know, especially, you know, in those larger communities. I mean, you've got thousands of people who are affected by road closures out bush. You know, you've got the likes of, you've got really large communities, Papunya, you've got Kirikara, Lake Nash, Canteen Creek's quite sizable, Yindamu, of course, but that's bitumen through to there now. But then you've got smaller communities and they still need their service as well. But that's also, those road closures on some of those roads, George, it's from where I sit, well, that's been the norm for the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, having those extended timeframes where roads weren't accessible. I'd never seen that previously for those extended periods of time. Yes, it was a big rain event that happened, but you know, these closures of these roads for these long periods of times had been happening for many years prior to the rain event that we had this year.
That's Kylie Staines, who is a director of Staines Transport, speaking there to George Nicol. Our text number is 0487 991057. I've got a message here from Peter in Berrima. He says, Matt, last month I drove Perth to Darwin and Adelaide to Darwin, and I've got to say, you notice very quickly how bad the roads get as soon as you cross the border. Is it any wonder we pay so much for freight? I can understand the frustration of our truckies and the damage they must take to their rigs. We need to do a better job on the roads in the Northern Territory, says Peter this afternoon. I know for my family, we sneak into the Kimberley a fair bit. And the joke is you're in the Territory driving along that Victoria Highway and it's bumpy, lumpy, there's potholes and the speed limit's 130 kilometres. And then you cross the border into Western Australia and the bit of highway on the other side of the border is, oh, it's like an airstrip. The tar is beautiful, it's big and wide, and they want you to slow down to 100 kilometres per hour. It's all back the front. It's unreal how good the tar is on that side of the imaginary line. So I know what you're saying there, Peter. Another text here this afternoon that says the amount of money that gets pumped into communities for housing is many times more than the actual roads out to those communities. And someone else asking the question, any compensation for loss of business due to the road conditions? I haven't heard of any compensation and I would not hold your breath.
Your bushfire emergency kit should contain items that can help if you find yourself caught in a fire. Your kit should include water and non-perishable food, first aid supplies, a battery-powered radio and torch with spare batteries, woolen blankets, and protective clothing made from wool, cotton or denim. Find more suggestions at abc.net.au/emergency. Your emergency broadcaster is ABC Radio.
It's 20 past one and you are tuned into the Country Hour, one of the big stories in the meat industry over the last few days has been this joint venture struck between JBS and an Indonesian sovereign wealth fund. What does the boss of Cattle Australia make of this new partnership? You'll hear from Gary Edwards next.
G'day, my name's Brody Woody and from Oklahoma, but I'm down under right now and you're listening to the Country Hour.
The chair of Cattle Australia says he's pleased with the news of a multi-billion dollar joint venture between meatpacker JBS and Indonesian sovereign wealth fund Danantara. Gary Edwards, he is also the founder of the investment group AAM, which owns a few properties in the Northern Territory. He says he understands this is essentially the first step in Danantara's larger investment plan for Australian agriculture.
Well, Danantara has had a stated interest for over 12 months now about investing in their food and protein supply chains to support food security into Indonesia. And obviously with the recent announcement as to what's occurred with JBS, I suspect that's the first of a number of announcements that will happen into the future. Indonesians have a very long memory of some challenges that happened in the cattle industry with the suspension of the live export trade in 2011 by the then Australian government. And since then, they've been looking at ways to ensure that they never face that food security risk again, because they saw the suspension of the live export cattle trade as a direct impact into their sovereign food security. So with the establishment of Danantara over the last 2 years, one of the stated parameters that Denantara has been looking to invest in is improved food security and their sovereign investment, not in complete ownership, but in partial ownership of agricultural supply chains and food supply chains that support the Indonesian population.
What do you think the impact of this venture will be on the Australian cattle market and perhaps the competitiveness of Australia's cattle?
Well, it's interesting that, you know, the Indonesian Denantara Group has taken the decision to invest in JBS. JBS is a wholly owned foreign company at the moment, but obviously is our largest protein processor in Australia across multiple categories. They're not only large in beef, but they're very large in sheep and lamb production and incredibly large in pork production. And they've also looked to get involved in aquaculture in Australia. So, you know, it's a stated investment, obviously, in the largest protein supplier, not just in Australia, but in the world. This particular investment is in the Australian subsidiary of the JBS business. But I think it's a good message that, you know, there's multiple countries that are still looking to invest in Australian production agriculture. And this is a great outcome and certainly provides surety for those that depend on the Indonesia as an export market. This is a great positive statement by Denantara that Indonesia is open for business and wants to do more business with Australia.
And certainly a really good sign for Australia, especially because Indonesia is one of the fastest growing, you know, meat importers in the world.
Yes, well, protein consumption in Indonesia has increased by 400% in the last 40 years and is only increasing as the middle class continues to grow. We must not forget, you know, that the population of Indonesia is 280 million people, and the top 5% with disposable income in Indonesia, which is equivalent to half of our domestic population, spend more on food than Australian consumers do. And protein in particular is in significant demand, and it's part of the health attributes that is being promoted in Indonesia, similar to how it was in China in the late 90s, early 2000s.
I know it's early days of this venture, but can you foresee any challenges that may have to be worked through?
Oh, look, I'm sure. I can't speculate in regards to the absolute details of the transaction because I'm not involved in it. But, you know, obviously Denantara and JBS have come to this arrangement based on the fact that they want a long-term partnership and exposure. These are long-term investments. You find that these things are not done for 1 to 2 years. They're done as generational investments. And I just think it's great to see that an announcement's been made. This is positive for Australian agriculture. It'd be great to see more Australian institutional investment in our food and agricultural supply chains. I think it's a tremendous shame that we don't see more of our sovereign funds investing directly like the Indonesian sovereign fund is here. And I think the Australian sovereign funds and the institutional investment industry in Australia can learn a lot about the strategic investment that Denantara has approached here.
I know you do have your own, I guess, like partnership with an Indonesian subsidiary there. Can you talk to me about what this venture will mean for AAM?
Well, it's great to see that, you know, from an AAM perspective, it's great to see investment from Denantara because it really demonstrates the commitment that they have in long-term investment in trade between Australia and Indonesia. And I think this is a pretty clear statement, not just for AAM, but for the entire agricultural sector of Australia, that Indonesia and the Indonesian government wants to do long-term business with Australia and Australian businesses. I think it's tremendous. And I, as I said, I'd like to see more investment from the Australian sector, but it's great to see that the Indonesian Sovereign Fund is leading the way here. For, you know, from an AAM perspective as a private business, you know, I hope and we expect to continue to see Denantara make further investments in supply chain investments and infrastructure to support more agricultural products, not just beef cattle, making their way to Indonesia. And I suspect Indonesia will become a significantly growing export destination and will have more economic trade between our two countries as a result of this this announcement and what will come in the future.
That is Gary Edwards, who's the chair of Cattle Australia. So the big news, in case you missed it, is that global protein giant JBS is selling a 25% share in its Australian and New Zealand operations to Denantara, this investment arm of Indonesia's sovereign wealth fund. If you missed our coverage yesterday, you can catch it via the podcast. It is time now on the Country Hour to head to the sale yards with all the latest prices out of Roma. Here is David Friend.
Roma agents yarded 7,831 head, a significant reduction of around 4,000 head compared to the previous sale. Cattle were sourced from the far west as well as the local supply district. All the regular buyers were in attendance, operating on a mixed quality market. At the time of this interim report, yearling steers under 20 kilos make the 456 cents a kilo to backgrounders. Yearling steers 200 to 280 kilos sell from 376 to 516 to backgrounders. Yearling steers 280 to 330 kilos selling from $4 to 542 cents a kilo, almost 23 cents a kilo stronger. Yearling steers 330 to 400 kilos make the 534 to lot feeders and 526 cents a kilo to backgrounders, almost 15 cents better. Grower steers 400 to 500 kilos sold to 488 to lot feeders. Grower steers 500 to 600 kilos sold to 458 to lot feeders. And bullocks over 600 kilos top to 440 to processors, almost 10 cents dearer. This has been David Friend from National Livestock Reporting Service at Roma.
Thank you for that, David. In the live export trade, there are two cattle ships due out of Darwin Port in the coming days off the back of what was a very busy week, the week just gone. We spoke to cattle exporter Patrick Underwood on yesterday's program. He said the high price of about $4.40 a kilo for feeder steers out of Darwin to Indonesia, he said that was a pretty tough price for importers, especially at this time of year. So an interesting time for the trade. Good if you're a cattle producer. A bit tough on the exporters and importers, it would seem. That's it for today's Country Hour. Enjoy those tomatoes. Watch out for rock melons on the Stuart Highway and keep it rural.